In 2007, the Babylon podcast was our last best hope for more Lost Tales. We thought it failed. But after WonderCon, it became something more. Our last best hope for more Lost Tales geeking. The year is 2008. The name of the show is the Babylon Podcast. And welcome back to another Babylon Podcast. I am Summer Brooks.
I'm Tim Callender.
And direct from the National Democratic Koshvention, it's Jeffrey.
Has the shower curtain contingent made their feelings known about the upcoming platform?
They have indeed. And we are, it was a tough decision, but we have decided to back Barack Clinton.
Now, you know what? It occurred to me that if Kosh were running for president, he actually wouldn't be running. He'd be gliding.
There you go.
And he'd have to choose a gliding mate.
Yes. Who would Kosh have as a co-dictator?
One of the Koshettes, I'm sure.
Oh, nice.
I got nothing. Nope, not gonna say it.
They were a very popular singing group in the 60s, I think.
the 60s, yes.
Yeah, one of the Vorlanitos.
Glide a lot in the Koshettes, right?
Yeah. I like that.
Oh, we're starting off on a low note here, aren't we?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
Well, look, all good.
Before we get into it, and tonight we're deep geeking on atonement, but it occurred to us as watching this that there is a surfeit of smoke and effects, and we were wondering if that was because there's no longer Vorlon in the show, but they wanted to not lose the ability to generate any smoke effect. Did they just write that into the script so it wouldn't be written out of the budget?
What are you talking? What scenes are you talking about?
The entire middle of the episode, there's a lot of smoke, and since we hadn't had any smoke since the Vorlons left, we were wondering: did someone just get to the end of the budget line and go, oh my God, if we don't use the smoke, we're going to lose it out of the budget. So we got to have we got to have a lot of smoke. What can we do that have a lot of smoke?
Right. No, actually, smoke is pretty darn cheap. So you could have smoke in every episode and not really. In fact, the truth is we had smoke in almost every episode. It just doesn't always read on camera. But what it does is it softens the picture a bit, softens the whole image. And oftentimes, it's also used as a way to give us an illusion of greater depth to a set than what actually existed.
Oh, okay.
Smoke 'em up, boys, we used to say. Yeah, exactly, right before you roll.
So it's
not only do you smoke them, but then you got to waft them.
So you have wafters?
You have to waft your smoke. You can't just smoke. You got to waft your smoke.
And how does one waft smoke?
Ah, funny you should ask. It's an ancient filmmaking art where you actually take what's called a flag. Usually it's a device that's used to block light from one area and or bounce it off to another area. And somebody sits off camera and waves it back and forth like a little...
So basically an intern with a large fan. A large
there you go.
Hand fan. He's just...
That's it. But there's an art to it. You don't just like put any monkey there. I'm telling you, you got to be a good wafter. You got to be able to waft just enough that the smoke doesn't collect, but not so much that it looks like you're in a hailstorm or something. So,
let me guess, there's a union for that, right?
There's
the Screen Wafters Guild.
Special training.
So there's a special like 6-hour course you've got to take on how to waft.
Waftology 101.
I could have been a grip, but man, the wafting really looked interesting, so I wonder for that. So were you a wafter on the set there, Jeffrey? Was that one of the many things that you did?
I have. I actually do give good waft, now that you mentioned it, Tim. Yes.
Wow.
That's why I get the big bucks.
Uh-huh.
I'm blushing.
You are just
now.
A multi-talented kind of guy.
Yeah.
I be one.
All right.
We should, in fact, that would be the new thing. Maybe I should just get business cards that say Wafter on it. I come from a long line of Wafters, actually.
Wafters.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay.
Enough with the
Wafter. All right.
Yeah, we had also mentioned how our good friend Robin Ecken Downs appeared in this episode. A tiny, tiny, small part.
As a Minbari?
Yes, he did.
Yep. Gray Council member number one, in fact.
Was that it? He didn't even have, like, a good name?
Didn't even have a name.
They already had a great name, Robin Ecken Downs.
Well, yeah, but
I mean, you know.
Hey, you know from the long history of science fiction credits, if you're just given a number, you're going to be cannon fodder.
Yeah, pretty much. That's why I was surprised that he was truly, that's the credit, huh? Great council member number one.
Yep.
It's just so not like Joe to do that. You would think that it would be like D'ONE.
That's funny.
Yeah, I will.
Here's Great Council Member Caput.
Exactly.
Oh, we have so run off the rails on this.
Oh, yeah. Well, maybe now is a good time to take a break.
Yes, we are going to take a very, very quick break and come back with Deep Geeking on Atonement. And there's a little bit of disagreement on this, but I'll let you hear us argue.
In a world where knowledge is power, in an age where time is the most valuable commodity, in a voice that's killing my throat, comes a podcast that will bring you wisdom in less than 1 minute a day. So join me, Martin Darkley, as we journey to enlightenment. Our teachers, classic lines from cinema history. Come then to moviemantras.com and begin a voyage to a higher state.
On the next Babylon 5.
You will enter the dreaming.
Delenn is forced to relive the darkest moment of her past.
A moment of rage. They deserve no mercy. It is a holy war now, Delenn.
But she is also about to uncover the secret of her true identity.
We are a world gone mad.
You would destroy the purity of our race.
On the next Babylon 5.
Digging down into the most obscure facts in fandom, this is
Jumping right back into the fray of the dangerous and sometimes tangential, or most of the time just out in deep left field geeking.
Exactly, and this is one that might get very tangential or out in left field. We are deep geeking on Atonement. If everyone has been following along in their books, like you should, you will know that this is the episode wherein Delenn is summoned back to Minbar to undergo the dreaming. And why she's undergoing the dreaming, who can say? Okay, I'll say it. This one has some very funny moments in it, but overall, it just doesn't do much for me. And it's not like it's bad in the sense of Grey 17 is missing bad or Infection bad. I understand the purpose of the episode in that it provides some essential backstory and also kind of, you know, fills in some logical, you know, it advances the overall arc in a certain logical way, but it just for me, was not all that compelling.
It is a slower pace than we've gotten used to, and I think it suffers from where it falls in the chronology, in the timeline of, you know, we're up, 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 boom, this slow-paced one, and then we, you know, start going back up.
Yeah, maybe, but, you know, part of my issue with it is that the plot device of the dreaming, it's too much, it has that too much of that fantasy element. It's one of the things that I originally objected to regarding the Technomages, and thanks to Gene Cavellos, I changed my mind about the Technomages, but that's neither here nor there. You know, it's just this kind of this nebulous thing. You know, you drink from the cup and then you kind of go hallucinate or relive, but your companion gets to kind of watch on it too. And, you know, it just, I don't know. I think there might have been a better, more compelling way to get that information across, because really it's more about backstory than anything else.
I think it's not more about backstory. It's about filling in certain holes for Minbari actions to come, I think.
I guess. I mean, because the whole, you know, I get there's that whole part again. You know, her clan is calling her back to Minbar because basically they're worried about her liaison with Sheridan.
Mm-hmm.
What that portends, okay. And they do it under the auspices, not the auspices, that's a bad word, but under the pretense of racial purity.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, as we find out. You know, and that's a theme that's been touched on a number of times throughout Babylon 5, so that's not out of place. And the continuing questioning of Delenn's motives by her own people is also a recurring theme. So that element isn't out of place. And I don't want to suggest that my difficulty with it is that it's repetitious. It's not that at all. It's just that, I don't know, it just really lacks something, especially for the whole big revelation that is, number one, that Delenn was the crucial vote that nearly brought humanity to extinction, and then number two, that she is a child of Valen in the genetic sense and not a metaphorical sense. And you know, I could see that that's big stuff, but somehow the delivery of it just doesn't really give it that kind of weight.
Yeah, the whole you've put this off long enough, come back and answer to your tribal elders thing, it rang kind of hollow because we hadn't seen her rebuff any messages or requests like that. Normally something that big might have been solved is like, you know, wait, when are you coming back to Minbar to address the situation we talked about? Oh, later, we're busy. You know, none of that. No hint,
right,
of it. Just all of a sudden, are you ready now? And you're like, ready now what?
Yeah.
And like I said, the pacing of it, I don't know, maybe it should have been better as a B story rather than an A story. I mean, some of it was important. And there was one thing that I caught, not this time that I watched it, but previously, that you have to wonder with Lanier, because the guide, you know, the assistant is supposed to guide them through the dreaming, help them realize certain things about what was seen. And
right,
you have to wonder how much of Lanier's personal feelings for Delenn colored his comments. He's like, oh, well, you're just hooking up with Sheridan because you feel guilty about killing so many humans. Well, that's it. You're going to have to stay here.
Well, you know, he mentions that, and when Delenn calls him on that, she says, that's not true at all. And he responds with, well, that's what they're going to think. As though, you know, he's just kind of playing devil's advocate.
Well, that's like wishful thinking on his part.
I hear what you're saying.
Yeah.
And you know, there are elements in there where, you know, Lanier is very much trying to be, I don't want to, not Lancelot, that's not quite the right figure I'm looking for, but he's there because he loves her, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's sitting there in the customs, waiting area waiting for her. It's like, oh, you're going to leave without me, you know. And, of course, he couldn't. You know, he's pledged himself to her side.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand what you're saying. Of course, at the very end, when Sheridan greets Delenn, as she returns to the station, you know, all of a sudden Lanier is just the spare part, and he feels it, too. So I don't know. I don't know how much of it is colored by his presence.
Not his presence. Just I felt he made that statement because of his feelings for her. It didn't change the message that she was seeing, but it sounded like he was trying to guide her towards an understanding that would have benefited him more than her.
Well, I mean, that could be true. Yeah.
Because, I mean, and you see her, why she runs back. She's like, wait a minute, I missed something.
Right.
And, you know, Dukat's last words. And the thing is, why didn't anybody think of this before? You know?
Right. I guess, you know, that's the thing that is intriguing. I mean, I've been really mulling this episode over in my mind since I watched it. And there are a lot of questions and a lot of intriguing questions, but unfortunately, they're not the kind of intriguing questions that you know are going to get answered later on. It's these things that are out there that you know are just kind of there for the episode and not really, there's no intent to flesh it out. Like you say, you know, why didn't they do this before? You would have thought that they would have made her undergo the dreaming before she crawled into the chrysalis. Because let's face it, that wasn't an entire secret. She wasn't, you know, there was a couple members of the Great Council who knew she was up to something.
The dreaming doesn't seem to be council related. It seemed to be caste or clan related. So they would have had no idea she was doing this.
Except that
I see.
Except that when she mentions that she was in the dreaming once, she was the guy for none other than Dukat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is I don't think they had enough time to send her into the dreaming because nothing had happened by then. You know, yeah, she was a member of the Grey Council and she was sent to Babylon 5 to be an ambassador and to keep an eye on Sinclair. There was nothing to undergo for the dreaming. Right,
sure
after, right after the change, perhaps, or, you know, but literally by this time, a lot has happened and they're like, okay, hang on a second. What are you doing?
Yeah, I guess. I don't know. I guess that's part of my consternation is this dreaming theme seems to have just kind of come out of nowhere.
And what's the real purpose for it?
And I know that's expecting too much, that every little aspect of Minbari society should have been spelled out for us by now. But,
well, it's not that we didn't know about it. It's what was the ultimate purpose for it? Because we see it here being used as sort of a weapon. Like blackmail,
prove to us, a tool for investigation.
Yeah, prove to us why you should stay with Sheridan, undergo this dreaming to let us know. But why is Dukat in there?
They were going to take the dreaming at face value. And mm-hmm. Their whole attitude was you're going to undergo the dreaming, and the dreaming basically is going to pass judgment.
Right. And so what was Dukat in there, and why was Delenn guiding Dukat? She wasn't what was going on there?
Right. Yeah, I don't know. That's part of it. It just doesn't quite hang together. Unless there's more to it. And again, this is one of those things that it's intriguing, and I want to learn more about it, but the intrigue is more because it's itching that geek sense that says there's something that doesn't quite hang together here,
mm-hmm.
not because this is the coolest thing ever and I want to find out more. You know, the other thing that I find curious is the relationship between Dukat and the Grey Council.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the implication is that it's almost an uneasy balance of power. The Grey Council is set up with three from each of the cast, so no one cast has greater power over any of the others. Yet you've got this one guy who seems to be in charge, and yet by the same token, he is reluctant to take certain actions for fear of reprobation or reprisal.
I didn't see it like that.
Well, the whole deal with, you remember the scene where Dukat in the dreaming, He calls Delenn into the Grey Council, and they're debating what to do about the humans, these humans that they've been hearing about. Should we contact them or not? And Dukat coaxes Delenn to give her own answer. He tells her, you know, afterwards that, you know, basically I used you to embarrass the Grey Council. And so, you know, Delenn says, well, okay, so that means we're contacting the humans? He goes, no, they're going to come back and say, here's the reasons why we don't. I just embarrassed them just to, you know, almost to say I'm in charge, but yet by the same token he says, you know, I'm not going to use my power as a club to beat them into submission.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, if you're, you know, if there's a leader, you would think at the very end he's the guy that calls the shots and says, all right, you know what, we're going to go contact these humans, and, you know, none of you have the simple curiosity of an acolyte. Well, I do. Let's go do it. You know, he basically was kind of rubbing their noses in it, and then just kind of, fear isn't the right word, but he's reluctant to push it any further. You know, it's uh-huh. like, it's just like power plays or something. It was very odd.
Yeah, and I wonder if there had to be a certain kind of balance between the leader and the council. Like he needed a quorum. Like he needed, you know, 5-4 or something in order to actually go through with his idea.
Right.
But it sounded like the entire council was against him, so he couldn't overrule them because it was just him by himself.
Right, but the implication was there that he could have had he wanted to.
True.
So, you know, and I don't know what that means. Again, that's one of those things. I'd like to look to know more, but it's more because, you know, it's itching at the geek spot in the brain. Now, however, you know, let's come back to this, because one of the things that's interesting is though overall I wasn't pleased with the general vibe of the episode, shall I say, there were some really, really fantastic moments in it. And let's start with Dukat, the actor who played him, I thought was really fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he really had that presence. There was a charisma there, and you could see why the Minbari would follow him, even when there is this kind of odd power-sharing thing going on.
I just liked, you know, that is somebody I would like to talk to, because his presence, he wasn't in the series very much. He's mentioned all the time, but his presence on screen has always just been very calm, very authoritative, but with a sense of humor also.
Right. Well, it's like for a, shall we say, a sketchily written character. I mean, he doesn't have the kind of fleshed out detail that our main characters have, like a Delenn or a Sheridan or a Nevada, okay? You know, we know who he is, but it's like the actor really seemed to inhabit the part. You know, he really brought Dukat alive as a real flesh and blood being, and not just, oh, you're playing the leader guy. Okay. Oh, I'm authoritative. You know, there was a sense of humor there. And I'm sure a lot of that has to do with the writing, but it's got to come alive in the hands of the actor. So that was fantastic. Mm-hmm. There were some, when the dreaming first begins for Delenn, and of course she's back in the full Minbari garb, if you will, and she's there with Dukat, there's a moment there where I wasn't sure, you know, her rapturous expression as she's talking with Dukat, and given what the apparent nature of the dreaming was, I wasn't sure whether that's Delenn as an acolyte enraptured to be in the presence of the great Dukat, or the present Delenn going back in time and realizing once again she gets to live those moments with Dukat again. It was a really nice layered, nuanced thing there. I really liked that part of it.
Okay, so what about the overall vibe didn't you like? Or was there one specific theme or something in there that...
I did the dreaming. I'll just be frank about it. I thought the whole dreaming thing was bogus. It was just kind of bogus. I think there could have been... And I don't know what it is. I know it's easy for me to sit here and say, oh, it should have been done differently. But there's something just more to give it a little more punch. You know, it's not the pacing. I just think it's that element there that just kind of floats over everything. You know, and they drink from the little cup, and they, you know, the big Get Smart doors open, and they go into the misty chamber, and, you know, and if, you know, at the end where she has K'Lane with her, okay, why didn't they just do that in the first place? Everybody come on.
Yeah. And
you know, I mean,
yeah.
I understand that it's tradition, perhaps, that you've only got the guide and the dreamer, but, you know, I don't know. Again, it just really struck me as a bogus way to get the information out.
It was a less than satisfactory way. I mean, we had most of those bits of information. We just needed a reason to go back and examine those bits,
mm-hmm.
and let that truth come out.
You know, what about this? I mean, would this have had more drama? Let's say it's not. Well, here you go. Here we go. If we're going to rewrite it, let's do it this way. Let's dispose of the dreaming, okay? Let's take the element. We know that Delenn's clan, and by extension the Minbari people, because that keeps coming up, they really don't want her to hook up with Sheridan because there's the whole racial purity.
Mm-hmm.
So what if they've got the records that says Delenn was the one who cast the vote to go ahead and hunt down the humans and exterminate them all? And what if this data crystal just happens to show up on John Starkiller Sheridan's desk?
Ooh, the threat of blackmail.
See, doesn't that all right there just become a much more dramatic, compelling story?
Mm-hmm. I don't think,
you know, because I'm sorry, go ahead.
I said she had only mentioned that she played a part in the start of the war. I don't think she actually ever tells him that she's the one who gave the full order, right?
Right.
Interesting.
You know, I mean, one of the other elements that keeps playing in there is Lanier's comment that, you know, Delenn says, oh, you know, you might learn things about me that you don't like. And he's like, well, no, I'll stand by you. And sure enough, you know, as a good friend, he would understand that kind of thing. But, you know, again, we're you know, cast it in the lovers,
mm-hmm.
okay? You know, they've got this relationship building. It's built on trust, and the heart does as the heart does. So what does the heart do when you find out that the woman you love nearly was responsible for the extermination of your entire people?
It's sort of the reverse of Romeo taking revenge for the killing of Mercutio.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, that might have been a great, I'm not saying that it would have, you know, torn them apart, but it would have been that place where, you know, you really see how dedicated Sheridan is to her, because he, you know, could say, look, Delenn, you did this. I blew up the Black Star simply by faking an SOS, you know, which wasn't honorable, but it struck a blow.
Mm-hmm.
We both did things, and that was then, and this is now.
Well, here's a question. Would that relationship have withstood another hit like that? Because he was pretty shaken by her not telling him that Anna was still alive.
Yeah, because I think it would have. Because, again, Anna's situation was a question mark that haunted him. You know, you know, the whole deal that he never got a chance to say he loved her,
mm-hmm.
before she disappeared. So there was never any closure. And then to find out that he could have had that closure, and this woman had, you know, that he was starting to have feelings for, prevented him from doing that. But I think the fact that, you know, what saves him at Zahadum when he's falling is that he recognizes the one thing to live for is Delenn. And I think, yes, this is one of those instances where, you know, I don't know if it sounds cliche or not, but, you know, you get to see that depth of character and that strength to say, you know, we made our choices. We made our decisions. Those were, you know, insane times. And we don't have to let that, you know, part of what's going on here is we don't have to let that control us anymore. You know, you can let that part of you go, because I love you now for who you are.
I don't know. With his difficulty at her keeping secrets from him, I don't know. It might have taken him longer to get over this one, because you think at some point she would have said, you know, hey, there's something more to this. And then you wonder if he would begin to wonder if she just had done all of that in order to try to make up for what she had done, because that was the first conclusion that Lanier jumped to, and right. He assumed that would be the first conclusion that her clan would jump to.
And by extension, perhaps John Sheridan would have jumped to. I don't know. We'll have to get Jeffrey to get Bruce Boxleitner back on. We'll ask
him.
Wouldn't that be fun?
That would be. Okay.
So, you know, so there you go. That's how I would rewrite that episode. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm a much better writer than JMS. But again, we also get some, you know, some fun stuff. There's that great scene where Zach is getting refit for the uniform.
And we
that.
Finally get the needle stick.
Yeah. She did that on purpose.
Like, yes, I believe she did.
And
I still go through there and try to figure out, okay, which one is she? And there's like, stick, there she is.
Yeah, right. Yeah, don't you forget it.
Oh, that's funny. And then the, yeah. Of course, we have the long, arduous trek to Mars.
Yeah.
That entire last
scene. You
have
to play with that thing. It helps me relax.
Seriously? If you take that line out of context without looking at the video, that's just wrong.
Well, he is playing with his pole.
He is. That's just wrong and funny. But it's the singing that continues on into the end credits that's just hilarious. Apparently, that was just ad-libbed. He just kept singing after the director cut the scene, and they kept it in. That's awesome.
Yeah, I know. I know. That's a great scene. I could sing. No, thanks. You've never heard me sing. Things like this can only end in gunshot. Love that. I love that.
That is a fun one. That is.
Yeah. And the mission, I mean, it makes sense to send Franklin. I like Sheridan's reasoning for that.
Yeah. He's got a low enough profile that he wouldn't be immediately stopped.
Right.
He's also a doctor.
Yep.
But he's also, you know, he's also on the command staff.
Yeah. So it carries some credibility.
Mm-hmm. And the whole Jakar's eye thing. I wish we could have seen like more little tidbits of him like looking around corners with the eye, because you know he did. As soon as he walked out there, he's like, yeah, playing with it like a little kid.
You know, it's tidbit is a good word. You know, this episode is full of those little tidbits. Ivanova being invited to the reception for the Drazi ambassador. And then she's you know,
the wearing
a green satchel, but she comes out of the lift.
Don't even ask.
And it looks like she had just been finishing pounding that guy's head against the wall. Great.
No, that looked like, you know, the last straggler on a group long bender, and no one is sure who did what to whom and how many times. Where did she get the cane, and why was she limping?
I know, right? Because
she
that was
wasn't
the other thing that was
limping when she went to the party. That's the scary part.
And did she have time enough to grab a cane? Well, maybe she did, because she had to whack somebody across the nose with it. I don't know. But it's great, because it just, you know, that's the kind of thing you like, because it leaves a lot to the imagination, and when you start filling in the details, it just gets all that much better. Yeah, and Sheridan's bemused expression, don't even ask. That's great. Great stuff. That's fun stuff. I like that.
Yes. I had forgotten just how funny in just being understated makes it more funny. She just walks out of the elevator, tells him to not ask, don't think about asking, don't ever ask me, and the little glance over his shoulder after she's like walked down the hallway where he's like, do I really want it? No.
Yeah. So let's see. We got Marcus and Franklin on their way to Mars to start establishing things, start establishing contacts and fighting back against Clark and his propaganda regime. Delenn has basically been atoned, and they've worked it so she's basically a war bride. That's how they are going to portray it to the Minbari people. So there we are. So I'd rate this episode on a solid meh.
Okay, I'll give you that. Because it is a little slower. I mean, you like someone who wants the background details, who wants to see what things they can pick up to that shed a little light on the past and what might be, have some implications on future events. It's okay for that, but execution-wise, I think we could have had a slightly better reason to use
and,
the
fog
machine.
Let's face it, you know, JMS can't hit home runs on every script. I mean, I recognize that. This is kind of the bloop single.
Yes. So, like I said, somebody had to make use of the smoke machine because it was in the budget. And they had to use it or else they wouldn't get that money back for the next episode.
Well, they'd already had the Vorlon ambassador's quarters.
Oh, that's right. They hadn't been using it. They hadn't been using it for the alien quarters, so they had to keep using it or else they'd get it taken away. Because we heard that's how Warner Brothers works.
Yeah, it's not if you don't use it, they take it out of the budget, absolutely. I think we solved another mystery.
Yes. Oh, we're going to get in so much trouble.
Joe, can you write us an episode with a lot of smoke machine effects? You even have it pouring out of the cup. Okay.
All right. I think we're done.
I think we're done, too.
All right. In that case, we will be back really quickly to wrap this up, maybe cause some more trouble.
Dear author, thank you for submitting your story, but I'm afraid we cannot use it at this time. It just didn't grab me. Grab you? You haven't had it long enough to read it yet. There must be a better way to put my stories out there for people to enjoy. But how? Form Letter Rejection Theater. With your host, Paulette Jackson. Join us each month as we bring you the best in previously unpublished short fiction, each tale brought to life with dramatic readings by the author and a full voice cast reading the dialogue. Coming soon to flrdpodcast.com.
And we are back after a minor technical break.
Mike only has 9 fingers working now.
Yes, he'll put some ice on that. He'll be fine tomorrow.
Wait a minute. What happened? Hang on. I woke up. What?
Well, that's good because I think Tim gave us something. Was this a voicemail or a comment? Well, same thing, but. Tim?
I sent you a voicemail that we should play, and I've also got a couple emails here.
Oh, okay.
And only one of them has to do with the JMS announcement.
Only one, wow.
Only one, yeah.
Finally dwindling down.
What do you attribute that to? Like, did we not get the message out?
Well, I think people got sick of the message.
Yes, I think that's it.
Oh, that could be.
And I've only got this one because it's pretty much addressed to Jeffrey, and you know.
Oh, okay. So let's.
Well, I'll go ahead and read that one right now. How about that?
You want to read that one first, or you want to play the other one first?
Let's read this one first.
Okay.
Okay. This comes to us from Gene from Greenville. He's a longtime listener. Here we go. Hi, Jeffrey Summer, Tim, Mike, and any other lurkers out there. I have a question for Jeffrey, from his perspective as an industry insider. About JMS's recent post. Are we fans taking the great maker's statement too seriously or more seriously than the WB would? I ask for two reasons. First of all, the reply given to Warner Brothers by JMS probably would have been phrased more diplomatically than the version we fans received. As you had said, he wouldn't just sever relations with the company completely. That would eliminate not only the possibility of future B5 projects, but also any other potential collaborations with Warner Brothers. Secondly, how seriously does a company take comments like these? Artists often make statements like this whenever they feel the studio is doing something to harm or change their work. Would they take his comments at face value, or would they assume that the statements were made in the heat of the moment and should not be taken literally, and give him time to cool off before contacting him or consider this a part of the negotiation tactic and be considering their counteroffer. Maybe that's how WB sees JMS's comments and assume that after he's had time to cool off, he'll come around or at least return to the table. Just wanted to know your opinion. So what do you think, Jeffrey?
Yes.
I mean, does that happen? Guys come out and say hot-headed things, and that's just because they're blowing off steam, and the studio execs kind of drum their finger on the table and wait for them to come back to the room? Or?
Oh, I think there are hundreds and hundreds of examples throughout Hollywood history where that's been the case, where, you know, someone has that opportunity to be interviewed and has the camera in their face and says something or this thing or that thing, or they leak something out through their PR department, or frankly, sometimes their PR people just start, you know, mouthing off because there hasn't been any action going or eight. I mean, you know, I'm not completely qualified to try to explain whether that happens 50% of the time, 40% of the time, or 70% of the time, but you know, it's all part of the ongoing dialogue, all part of the negotiation, all part of the relationship between creative and distributor. And so that I'm not sure he said anything that wasn't completely true. It was like, was it this or was it that? Well, yeah, probably both. Could have been one or the other.
Yeah, one of the things that occurred to me as I've been, you know, mulling this over and reading all the emails, because they're still coming in even though they're slowing down a bit. This is the first time I can think of where a creator has basically said, well, that's it for the show. You know, in other words, it's like Firefly comes along, we get 18 episodes, and Fox cancels it. Or The Tick comes along, we get 9 episodes, they cancel it. And, you know, and we as fans go, okay, you know, we love the show. Those mean, evil studio executives, they've taken away our toy and we're really mad. But in the end, that's just kind of how it's done, and we recognize it. You know, to cast it in a different light, you know, what if Gene Roddenberry had come along and said, nope, you know what, we're not going to make any more Star Trek. Sorry, we're done. You know, for whatever reason. You know, it's that kind of a thing. I think that's as much what has shocked fans as anything else.
I don't disagree. It is not typical, not unprecedented, but not typical that a creative would close their own door. Usually, you know, the more prevalent and prominent way that programming comes to an end is because the programming is no longer sellable, or there's not a distributor that cares to keep making, you know, investing in new product. So, this is a bit of the unusual. And again, all of this rhetoric has to be kept within the context of it was statements made to the fans rather than statements made between agents or, you know, in the room, so to speak. So, and that's data that we just don't, you know, we just don't have.
Okay. Well, let's move on to more important stuff.
Well, and sitting here as an outside observer, listening to all this conversation that's happened over the last several weeks, I look at it and think, wow, what an amazing amount of conversation and interest and focus that JMS got off of one little press conference and one little statement.
It wasn't even a press conference.
Well, not even a press conference, but just one little statement.
Yeah.
And there's a lot to be said about that.
You know? Oh yeah, I mean, obviously it's a passionate fan base, and we've talked about that. And I don't know. I think I'm even beginning to think we've kind of beat this Pac Mara to death.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, let's go on to more important things. This is a much more pressing bit of information. This comes to us from James in Tallahassee. He says, "Hey, y'all, just thought I'd send off a quick response to the Viper versus Star Fury discussion in episode 124. See, I told you it was more important." "Sorry, Tim, but having the engines mounted way out on struts would not make Star Furies more maneuverable. Yes, moving thrust away from the center of mass would increase torque, longer lever arm, but you have to take into account the mass of the engines, too. Ultimately, moving large masses out that far would make the fighter turn more slowly. I still think the Star Fury is a great design, but the key element is the G-force load on the pilot, excuse me. Obviously, Earth lacks any kind of artificial gravity, and therefore any kind of inertial dampening, if you pardon the technobabble. So having the pilot at the center of rotation will reduce the G-forces on the pilot when a Star Fury spins. That is probably the best explanation for the design of the Star Fury. As a side note, Thunderbolts would therefore be a compromise. The horizontal cockpit located further forward would be a disadvantage for overall maneuverability, but would be a sacrifice engineers would have to make to design an atmosphere-capable fighter. Now, we know that the Colonials in Battlestar Galactica had artificial gravity, and it is possible that Vipers have some kind of inertial dampening based on this technology. So I've got to side with Summer. Although I love Star Furies, they would be fragged by Vipers." Well, you know what? I guess I can't argue with that. Get called on my faulty physics and be a culprit there. And,
Okay, I just want to see the matchup. That's all I want.
There might be some gifted CGI guys out there right now putting that together, I hope.
Well, Mojo worked on both shows, so, maybe he should
put
something up for us here.
And you should know that Gary from Jacksonville is involved in the B5 versus BSG discussion at Dragon Con.
Oh, God.
So I hope he gives us a report back, because he said he's going to use part of this as a discussion.
I hope he's sitting there with a recorder.
Yeah. And I wonder how much inertial dampening there really is in the Viper, because remember when Starbuck had injured her knee, she couldn't get her flight status back until her knee could take, 3 Gs?
Right.
Yeah.
And here's the other point. If you're going to borrow the technobabble, the inertial dampening is really used at relativistic velocities. You're talking about, multiples of the speed of light. So, when they're just on maneuvering thrusters, nobody's really worried about that. So I'm with you. I don't know if that is as, if that is as much an issue as James is suggesting.
Well, the nature of the inertial dampeners are only to take the big forces. So small maneuverable forces would still be enacted on the body.
Yeah, but you're not worried. You're not, like I said, you're not at those high speeds. Come on, get your
podcast. I just want to see it.
Mike, I want you to derive your
I just want to see it. I just want to see it.
I want to see your math. Write that out for me.
There you go.
but wait, this is the question I have. If we talk about a force that is 3G, that's three times your gravity weight, correct?
Mm-hmm. That's not that much.
If a person weighs 100 pounds and they're subjected to 3G, their equivalent weight, the pressure upon them, forces being exerted on them, is 300 pounds.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. If you're in a zero-G environment, and you multiply that by three times, three times zero is still zero.
No, you're not see, at that point, though, you're not dealing with gravity, you're dealing with acceleration.
Oh, so you want to change the phraseology here?
No.
that's what they call it.
That's what they call it.
And 3 Gs is not that much, folks. I mean, our pilots are trained to, what is it, 6?
8. I mean, I know some of the fighters, they'll pull 8 Gs.
Yeah, 8 Gs, 9 Gs. Yeah. I mean, that's nothing new. Hell, 3 Gs isn't even hardly takeoff. I mean, they're pulling way more than that just on takeoff in the space shuttle. So 3 Gs ain't that much. So maybe there's some inertial dampening, but not full inertial dampening.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just partial. It's helping, but it's not alleviating all of it, so you got to be able to take some G-force because
I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to remember the scene where because Adama put like 8 plates on that leg press, and she
and her leg buckled.
Yeah.
God, this is a geeky show.
Let's see, four times
true,
90.
True performance.
Yeah, that was true eight plates is 360 pounds.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's it.
That's actually kind of funny.
We can do math. Yeah.
It's actually kind of funny because I used to.
Here's like the other part to it is I don't what's kind of a wild card in the discussion is we don't know how much thrust is being generated by the maneuvering thrusters. So in other words, James' point is a good one regarding the mass of the engines out at the ends of the wings on the Star Fury, but conversely, on the Vipers, they've got those little nose thrusters that are helping them whip around, but how much thrust is being generated by those compared to what a Star Fury generates for maneuvering?
Interesting.
Okay, guys, just so you know, you're going down a rabbit hole that will never, ever end. I know this from experience from how many episodes of the other show that never went away? Yeah.
Mike, we've just about played out the whole JMS announcement thing. That got us about a month and a half worth of material. So.
Okay, we're on the way then.
we're done with that. Until a surprise.
Yeah, we need something to replace it.
Yes.
And gnomes.
No. We did the Babylon 5 gnome thing last week. We're done with the gnomes.
Yeah, no more gnomes on this show. We are not crossing gnomes.
No more gnomes.
Lord. Gnomes are about done on the other show, too. Yeah. Ooh.
Tim, the true measure of any performance is the size of the wet spot in your pants.
You're sitting in a puddle of excitement, aren't you?
Oh,
kind of, that's what it comes down to.
That was a winging it topic.
That was a visual I didn't need, but okay.
All right, do you have any more email or?
No, that's a free email.
Okay, so play this little message.
Hi guys, this is Rod. I've been a long time listener to the Babylon podcast. Love it dearly. Love it. I have to say, I finally was pushed into to leaving a voicemail simply because I guess I expect in any discussion of the fourth season of the show, I always expect the usual complaints and that it really got compacted down because they thought that might have to be the last season. And I can understand those to a degree. I have some of the same complaints. But I always find it amusing that the most audacious thing Straczynski did in the whole run of the show was how he ended the Shadow War. He did the exact opposite of what was expected. He didn't bring us to a large Star Wars-style battle, a humongous space fight that we win and we conquer and we stand over our defeated enemies and we shout hallelujah. He did something smarter. And even at the time, I loved it. And I've always heard people complaining about it. And, of course, I knew whenever the episode got discussed on here, it would be the same way. But it's just disheartening with this many years between seeing it and discussing it that there's still people out there, no names mentioned, that still don't, I mean, they maybe accept how amazing it was and how brilliant an idea it was, and pulling it off was astonishing. But they still just can't get past it. I guess they want the big explosion to end the film or to end the story or to wrap all the things up and to defeat the enemy and to stand over them and to do the Tarzan shout. I was always utterly stunned by that. I could not believe the audacity. It was astonishing. And, well, it'll always be a bone of contention with fans, of course, but I love it. Love the podcast, too, by the way. I love it. Keep it up. You do a great job. Thanks.
Thank you.
Oh, by the way, I guess I should tell you my name. My name's Rod Barnett. I live in Nashville, Tennessee. I wonder if that even matters. See y'all later. Bye.
Of course it matters, Rod.
Of course it matters.
I do hate
of course it matters.
Advised.
Oh,
somebody want to get that?
Call?
Yeah. That's the end.
I'll let me get it.
That's awesome. Wait, no, I got it. No, seriously, I got it.
So I think maybe he might have misunderstood some of the bone of contention, at least for me. I don't care that it was ended that way. It was a good storytelling, an unexpected thing. I just, the execution of it, I thought could have been better.
It lacked a certain drama. But I'll say this. I mean, to me, one of the most audacious things is, and we know in hindsight, it was driven by factors beyond Straczynski's control, but the show was apparently all about this big shadow war thing, okay? And four episodes into the season, he ends it. I mean... Yeah, to me, that's the audacious thing, because then you're standing there going, well, what's the rest of the show going to be about? You know, he's got 20 more episodes to go. Oh, my God, what's going to happen now? Mm-hmm. And that, you know, even had he gone to the fourth season and in the fifth season, Straczynski has said, end of the fourth would have been the end of the Shadow War, and then the whole fifth season would have been the, Earth Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
Even that is still pretty audacious, because that's basically saying, I'm changing what you thought the show was about.
That's true.
So,
and we also have, remember, the original premise was this was supposed to be one story, and the resolution to the next story was going to be a spinoff, the Babylon Prime.
Yeah, right.
So he had to change a lot of stuff midstream. I could see where a lot of stuff might have been lost, but. Oh, I want more. Little tidbits, please.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of those things. I think that ultimately with the events that happened in the real world, our world, that impacted the production of Babylon 5, I think in a number of ways that actually strengthened the final product and the story that we got. But, Straczynski has said he plotted out the general shape of the universe for a million years forward and a million years back. It's a lot of space to tell some stories. Oh, sigh.
Yeah, no, you're onto it, though, because that's because the people who argue that it should have been a bigger explosion, that's because we it's part of our human history. We understand that. That drama, because we've witnessed that in wartime in our own existence, and that's the nature of, that's typically the nature of battle is, you go to battle until only one is standing.
Right.
And
and you do get that with the resolution of the Earth Civil War. That is your big Star Wars thing, if you will. But that, that's one of the brilliances, because he sets up Into the Fires, the big, gigantic, huge battle with fleets coming together, and they all meet up and then just kind of stare at each other. So, Brad, I think we're in agreement with you. I think it's a brilliant concept, but as Summer just said, the execution of it didn't quite meet that. Anyway, so there it is. And that's all the feedback we have for this week.
Excellent.
We got more feedback waiting for the next feedback of Palooza, but I thought this would be a good one. Yeah.
When will that be? End of mid-September?
Yeah, I think it's coming up in the next couple weeks.
All right.
So send your cards and letters in, people.
Excellent. Sounds like
that was your cue, Summer.
We are done. We are definitely done. If you want to leave your cards, letters, thoughts, comments, complaints, the place to email those to is babylonpodcast@gmail.com, or call in your own comment. We can email you a comment too. You can record it yourself and fill Tim's email box. That's what I'm suggesting. Record it yourself so we don't get the feedback all the time. And don't do noise reduction because it just makes it sound bad. But you leave
and us. Vipers will kick Star Fury's butts.
Yes, and if you have any arguments for that, save it. We'll talk about it later. The place to go is BabylonPodcast.com. We have a spot in Second Life. Come visit us. Say hi. Listen to the live feed in there. Donate. There's a great big donate button on the website. Please help us out because we use all of our budget moving the studio. And Mike's going, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I want to keep my big internet pipe. Please send
there.
Money.
Not going. But if you want to call in your own voicemail, just leave it for us to do all the editing. That number is 206-338-2259. That's 206-338-2259.
The year we had to use up all the smoke and waft it around.
And we will see you next time on the other side of the non sequitur.
Waft this.